Speaking of reliability. Friends talking about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Carl Carlson.
Hey, Carl. I think we've been on the phone or on Skype for about 5 seconds, and I said, let's hit record. And you had mentioned that you are not sure about your internet connection and how well it's going to work with recording. And so let's just say right up front for the listener, if Carl fades in and out a little bit, we're relying on a whole bunch of devices, and we're not even sure who owns most of them or created most of them in order to get enough bandwidth to record. So Carl, do you know of, you know, would you have an estimate of how many devices are between us for this recording?
I really don't know, but quite a number.
Right. I mean, you mentioned that you're using your phone as a hotspot, and you have a microphone and a headset and a computer, and then there's a cell tower involved someplace, and then the equipment there, and so on. And my end, it's a microphone, headset. I've got a I don't even know what it's called. It's a little red box that my microphone plugs into, and equipment in my house. Connect to the internet cables that come into the house and so on, not to mention the software. But just the other day, actually, it was coming back from Rams. My wife said, "We have too many gadgets that when you leave, I don't know how to run or don't have access mm-hmm. to run." And it became most important. I think I told you about it at Rams is that we had just recently purchased a coffee maker that's internet enabled, right? So you can set how many cups and what temperature and a bunch of other parameters on it through an app, but the device itself only has one button. You can turn on the pre-programmed one or not, but you can't change it. And lo and behold, she didn't want to make the same recipe that I had set up in there and didn't have a way to change it.
Yeah.
So just recently our oven failed, and she went out to buy a new oven, and I said, so are you going to get one that's internet connected so that we can use an app or run it through Alexa or something like that? And she goes, no way.
Yes. Yeah. The what's interesting, Fred, is the when you get multiple devices, you get interface and integration issues that go beyond the individual company. So I'm with a Samsung phone and a particular model of laptop, and then you have the we're using an AT&T signal, mm-hmm. and all of these have to interface with each other, and that is where the highest risk, in my opinion, is in integration and interface issues. I've always found empirically that more than half problems occur at interfaces. And so I think a given device manufacturer may do a really good job on their device, but it can sometimes break down when you have multiple interfaces and integration areas that are almost too many for them to anticipate.
And well, then new interfaces and standards keep coming up. Right. It's one of the areas where standards actually make sense. A standard plug and receptacle and how you use that, like the USB plugs. Right. They're ubiquitous. Use my fancy word for the day.
OK.
Right. But the communications from your phone to whichever carrier you're using, there's a whole raft of things that have to happen for that to work. And internet, right? The structure of a packet has to have certain things in it so the routers can know where to send it. And if those aren't to that standard, they just don't work. internet addresses. There are elements of our communication systems, larger communication systems, but even within and between devices that just need to work. I'm thinking of my entertainment center. I've got, I don't know what, how many brands of things I've got cobbled together up there, but they all have HDMI cables and plugs on them, right? And they can all talk through those cables. So it works. Yet we become more and more dependent on the, not only the interfaces, but just the devices themselves working.
So let's explore this from a reliability standpoint. I think we could agree that the more interfaces and integration of different types of equipment, the more opportunity for reliability problems. And so that's one fairly straightforward aspect of this conversation. And the other part of it is that if you're working in a given company, like a cell phone manufacturer or a laptop manufacturer, then you have to, and I know this is the case, I mean, they do this, is you have to anticipate all the different types of configurations that customers will use. And of course, the problem there is it's such a moving target because there's startup companies and we're adding apps, we're adding devices that maybe were not anticipated originally.
Right.
So just a couple interesting aspects from a reliability standpoint. One of the things, Fred, that comes to mind is the subject of standards. And I'd love to explore this, maybe not in this podcast, but in a dedicated podcast, because you mentioned the value of standards, and I completely agree. There's an area of value, then there's an area of non-value.
Yeah.
And so at some point, let's articulate that, and I'd just be so interested in listener feedback on that topic.
Yeah. No, I'm going to make a note that we'll come back and look at the good, bad, and ugly of standards or something like that. One of the things I'm finding, though, is I have some smart light bulbs in the house, right? And the other day, our internet cable was down. There was high winds and probably lost a cable someplace along one of the telephone lines. But we had power, but we didn't have internet. We could still control the lights, right? The local network just within the house had the capability of controlling the lights. So I could turn them on and off with my app and do other things. I didn't have to resort to walking, as my wife would say, walking all the way across the room to the light switch, which is said facetiously. On the other hand, there's a couple of devices that we have in the smart devices that we have, like the coffee maker, for example, that if there's not an internet connection, you can't control it because the design of the interface, it relies on going back to the server at the mothership, for example.
Right.
And so it's something as important as a coffee maker. Maybe I need to figure out a better way to control it.
Does everything need to be smart? I mean, there's a marketing aspect to smart, but we bought a cooking device called sous vide, which is a great way to cook slowly and controlled in a controlled manner. Mm-hmm. And the high-end sous vide was a smart sous vide, which is Wi-Fi connected. And all it did was so that you could remotely turn it on and off. And we looked at each other going, well, why would you want to do that? You're already in the kitchen. You can push the button. Why pay an extra $50 to have it remote? It just adds one more thing that can fail.
Yeah. Now, see, I looked at that the exact same situation, right? I saw the two different ones. One had the control panel essentially right on top of the device, and the other one didn't. And I looked at the control panel as being more electronics, more buttons, more portals for water and whatever to get into the system and make it fail. The one that I got is the one you didn't like because it was internet connected. It had, other than the water inlet and the water outlet, it was sealed. Mm-hmm. Right? So there really wasn't anywhere for, I was thinking, I'm going to put this in a water bath, you know, in hot water. I want one that's sealed from that, from the condensation and steam and all that stuff. So I can run it from an app and I can run it through Alexa. It doesn't mean that I couldn't use the buttons on the top of the system just as easy, because I agree with you. You're in the kitchen anyway. But that was my rationale, is the less openings on a device in an area where there's lots of moisture would be better. And plus it looked cool.
Well, and very good. And we're looking at it from the point of view of consumer. Now just let's flip it from the point of view of a manufacturer or mm-hmm. a reliability engineer. Is reliability has a place at the table in systems engineering, and marketing will want to increase the marketing pizzazz by adding smart features or other things that may or may not be in the interest of reliability. And I'm not saying that reliability shouldn't step up. They should, if it's really needed. The question is whether or not the feature has value sufficient to justify the additional effort that's needed to make the feature reliable. And that's where the trade-off occurs at the systems engineering table.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. And you make a good point. It's a trade-off. It's the keypad and the control circuitry for the interface on your device versus a Wi-Fi or some other, I don't know if it's Bluetooth or Wi-Fi connection within the device, and antennas and signal strength and all of those factors. It's a trade-off of how you're going to actually provide the controls. So I don't know which is more or less complicated, but that's a good point. And from a reliability point of view, it was my original question when I was thinking about what we talk about today, is when you're designing a product, we often don't, as reliability professionals, often are not in the room when the concept, the architecture and concept and the feature set is being put together. And it's exactly these kinds of discussions. What's the use case, and is the feature enough of a benefit to outweigh the complexity that's involved with it, especially if it's adding more interfaces like the smart devices are doing?
Well, and that's the fun of a podcast, is we distill it to some really important, hopefully, some really important messages. And one of the messages here is for reliability practitioners to, I'll use the swimming analogy, swim upstream mm-hmm. to that point of concept development. It took me quite a while when I was at GM to get at the right place at the right time on new product development. Usually for years, the new product development, I'd find out about it after the concepts were identified. But by effort, I got into the concept discussion topics mm-hmm. and helped bring reliability into the discussion. Instead of merely looking at marketing and other types of conversations, I wanted reliability to be considered as part of concept development.
Yeah, and I agree with you. It's swimming upstream is probably the right analogy. It's from what I understand, and having been involved in a number of different organizations with these discussions, is it's the entrepreneurs, the founders, the folks that are closest to perceiving what the customer needs, and there seems to be an urge to keep the team small, keep the team fast, and get the concept created and then mulled over and massaged, but answer the questions, is there a market for this? Seems to be a driving factor. And I think where that, and to be fair, the people I've ever worked with in this realm truly want to make a product that works. It's just not top of mind. It's not with the, you know, when you and I walk into the room, It's like, well, if you add that feature and that feature, it relies on these 15 different companies doing their part right. What's the chance of that not working? Right?
Yeah.
We think kind of negatively sometimes, I think, is part of it. But it's raising those trade-offs at the concept phase allows the architecture to be crafted in a way to minimize the reliance on these interfaces that we've started the conversation with.
Well, let me see if I can articulate a thought I was having while you were talking. I don't want, as a reliability team player, I don't want to come across negatively. In other words, I don't want to sit at the table and say, well, you can't do that. That's
right.
Going to cause this problem.
Right.
I don't want that to be my focus. The way I want to do it and the way I've tried to do it is to say, if you want to do that, consider this. In other words, let's do away with this bracket. If you want to add this feature, let's do away with this bracket to make it integral so something won't fail. Or let's add some type of robustness project, or let's make it work in the following way. Mm-hmm. And if you have those conversations early, sometimes you can make adjustments in the concept that are very inexpensive, but become very expensive later on.
Right. Right. Yeah, I agree with you completely. It's the have you considered is a good thought. It still can come across mm-hmm. negative if that's your only banter of it. And we've talked about it before, I'm sure, in the podcast with one or more episodes, is that you need to also bring solutions, right? If we say, oh, right. You want to use this in a wet, humid environment, well, what about corrosion? How are we going to avoid that? And the options include seals and coatings and remoting the sensitive parts. You know, what's our strategy to minimize the chance of this occurring because we have a high-risk environment for that?
Yeah, exactly. So I think learning how to be a player that's positive, that's effective, that brings solutions to the table is part of our maturity as a reliability community, so that we don't come across negatively. Alternatively, you sit in the background and you wait until it's almost too late, and then you find out by testing or other type of analyses that you have serious problems. So I think it's worth the effort to swim upstream.
Yep, definitely is. Yeah, that's the other part is I've seen people get invited to those meetings and they're there to take notes about what they're going to do for testing rather than using their insights to go, that's a risk area. And rather than waiting until you have enough prototypes and test time to show that it's a problem, even just considering it early on can, like you said, Carl, it can make a subtle difference that is not terribly expensive early on, but prohibitively expensive when you get later in the program.
I've used a technique called Concept FMEA, which is a very shortened version mm-hmm. of FMEA. And I've used that on like Concept A, Concept B, Concept C. Mm-hmm. And that then says, in addition to looking at the feature and maybe the cost and timing factors that you take into account, let's take a look at the characterize that through Concept FMEA and then add that to the items to consider, or the factors to consider is a better way to put it. So that's worked pretty well. I'd be really interested. Fred, do you have any techniques you use or have used in the early stages swimming upstream?
I think the most effective is one is raising awareness. It's just asking the questions. Where are we going to use this? What's the environment? How often it will be used? What's the most likely thing that's going to fail? Or what area do we not know enough about to nail down in the concept or the design yet? Where do we need more information? And I often ask that just so I can get an action item that enhances our ability to make decisions around the reliability of something. Do we want to use metal or plastic? Well, how are we going to decide that, and what information do we need? And let's go get that. And it might be purely functional, at that realm, but those kinds of decisions really do impact the reliability in the long term. So it's including that kind of questioning and raising awareness. The other one is to go and say, you know, if we're in a hot, humid environment with lots of corrosive gases, how are, you know, just we know that we have a corrosion issue. What's our strategy and how do we know it's going to be good enough?
Right.
You know, it's for the things that are we as an engineering team or as a design concept team is going, if we make this product, it's pushing the boundaries this way or that way. There's going to be some unknowns as to how much of a margin is there or how robust it will be in that area. And then it's the suggestions are, well, let's get more information by doing some coupon testings or working with vendors or doing some quick analysis to figure out what kind of risk we're really facing here and how serious is this threat to the product surviving.
Yeah, very good. The two thoughts come to mind. One is to add to the conversation. One of them is a technique I try to avoid is reliability prediction.
Yeah.
That early in the concept stage.
You're talking about parts count prediction in general or just any prediction?
Both.
Okay.
The tendency is for the management team to say, okay, we're on the concept stage, we have concept A, what do you predict the reliability to be? And it's so early with so many variables, it's fraught with try to pull out a handbook or what have you. That's a podcast in itself. Mm-hmm. Is the pitfalls to predicting, particularly early in a program. But what I do try to do, and I was just looking, I called up an example of a concept FME that I did. And here's, the end result is a concerns column. And I just read one of the concerns that I'd like to share with you. We were looking at a new type of cable, and they were changing the material, and the concern was currently, just as an example, the model seems to generate, like you said, the right questions and to express the right concerns. So then you can follow up with some type of DOE or whatever that you need to surface the issues early.
Yeah, you get as we mentioned early in the program, we had concerns about our bandwidth, and it's garbled up a little bit of that. But Carl, what I gathered was it's that concept FMEA in part results in a concerns list, and it informs then actions, whether it's design of experiments or analysis or early experiments to get more information. To know if that's a good concept early on or not. So it's, well, I think we're pushing our bandwidth for some reason. You're not moving, are you? You're parked, I take it?
Right.
Okay. Let's ask our listeners what's your technique on it? Carl and I, acknowledge that so many products using smart devices as an example, but many, many devices are created in the concept phase, and we're not often a part of that conversation. And if you are, I guess there's two questions. One, how do you swim upstream? What's a technique that you've seen work or as helpful for you? But two is, once you get there, what's your motive? What do you need to do, and what is your focus? Now, we tended to focus on raising awareness of the risk areas and where the least margin is and what can we do to understand them better. There may be other techniques, and so we'd love to hear from you on what those are. So please head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. And it's a great place to leave us some feedback or comments. And also you can find us on LinkedIn and on Ascendo in many different places. So we certainly do love to hear from you. And once you get invited to that concept meeting, have fun and make a difference. It's, I think, where reliability professionals are the most effective at influencing the reliability of the product or system you're putting together. We have even just one question can make or break a product. And so don't be shy to bring your knowledge to bear there. So with that, Carl, if you're still on the line, any last thoughts?
No, I think you said it very well, Fred. I agree completely.
All right.
And so we'll wrap it up. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, Carl.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.